Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast. This session was recorded on the 20th of February 2014 at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, located in Melbourne CBD. In recognition of Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month in February, Brecan and Ovarian Cancer Australia hosted an information session with Professor David Botell, the head of the Australian Ovarian Cancer Study, a collaborative national project involving over 2,000 women with ovarian cancer. He presented on the latest developments to come out of this study, including new thinking on genetic testing and updated information on the latest drug treatments. We hope you enjoy this session.
Okay, so am I live now?
You're live.
Okay. All right, well, I'm actually tethered here by this and my laptop by a short cable. But the intention isn't for me to stand behind the lectern and sort of lecture to you. I'm very happy for this to be a sort of an interactive process within the constraints of the time. So if you've got questions along the way, don't hesitate to ask. If you've got questions that are more about you individually, that might be better for the end, and I'll be able to stay around for a little while before I'll get shot by my wife if I don't go to a function that I'm supposed to be at with her. But yes, do interrupt me along the way. I've tried to make the talk as accessible as possible to people who are not molecular biologists. I shouldn't have been in the room. And yet it still is a complicated area, as Alison said. So if there are things that you want to clarify along the way, don't hesitate. I will talk a little bit about our research, but again, the purpose isn't to, you know, to showcase all the research that we're doing. What I'm going to try and do is just tell you where the field is at in terms of its understanding of ovarian cancer, which has changed a lot in the last 5 years. Some of you may have heard this talk before. If you have, sort of bear with me. I've refreshed it in different parts, so it's up to date. And particularly at the end, I'll talk about some current local clinical trials. There are many, many clinical trials happening internationally in ovarian cancer, but there's some trials that have just kicked off locally that you might want to be aware of. I should also say that I'm not a clinician. I'm a molecular biologist, genetic engineer, I guess. But I've worked in medical research all my career, and I've worked on ovarian cancer for about 15 years. So that's my background. Or part of my background. So here's sort of an outline of the talk. Now I've forgotten to get my laser pointer ready. Oh, so it's all right.
Do you want me to do it?
Look, if you can. It's sitting there in the top of that.
Yes. Okay.
I'll just tell you a little bit about me and our research directions in the Australian Ovarian Cancer Study. Tell you how what we understand about ovarian cancer has changed so much in the last 5 years. And one of the surprising facts, as I'll explain, is that most ovarian cancers don't come from the ovary, which sort of puts little bit of a question mark over that name, but we were discussing this downstairs, and I think to change the name at this stage would just confuse everyone. I'll tell you a bit about genetic risk, because that is often of interest to people in this setting. I'll say a little bit about early detection, and often we hear the question, why isn't there an early detection test out there, you know, the equivalent of a mammography screening, why is this disease diagnosed late? And I'll just explain why that's been such a difficult task and remains a difficult task. And then, as I said at the end, I'll talk about some of these clinical trials which some of you may be interested in. So a little bit about my background. For a decade I was the director of research at Peter Mac. Peter Mac moved from, some of you will remember it, down where the county court is now located, and in 1995 it moved to its current site behind Parliament House, and at that time it was quite small in terms of its research program. It had about 70 people involved in research, and then for various reasons we were able to grow it when I was there as scientific director, and then I was director, and now there's about, I think at last count it's about 550 people involved in research.
research. And I think one of the real strengths of PETAMAC is that it combines both laboratory research right next to, physically, literally next to the clinic. And so there's a very dynamic interplay between the scientists and the clinicians, which makes for great translational research. I'm head of the Australian Ovarian Cancer Study, and I'll tell you a little bit about what that means in a moment. I'm head of the Cancer Genetics and Genomics Program at PETAMAC, and that relates to my background in as a genetic engineer and understanding genes, and I'll describe for you what the genes do. I'm a professor at the University of Melbourne. I serve on various groups. I'm very involved in ANSTOC. Some of you will know about ANSTOC, a wonderful organisation. So this coordinates clinical trial activity in Australia. And then there's the GCIG, which is essentially a collaborative of all these collaboratives. So it's where ANSTOC and GOG and JGOG and all the different European and Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere cooperative groups in Guyana get together and coordinate. I'm involved in the NIH in the US and involved in a program associated with the EU. I also have a part-time job in London, which is a bit of a long commute, and another one in Boston at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And I also have some skin in the game. That's my mum, the father, who died of ovarian cancer in the early 90s. So I think that's the thing about cancer, that everyone has skin in the game. I think it's just, it's a disease that touches all of us either directly or indirectly in some way. Okay, so a little bit about the Australian Ovarian Cancer Study. I don't know how well that projects, but this is a picture of Australia, and these are all the hospitals, or lots of hospitals that see women with ovarian cancer. And back in 2000, we were lucky enough to win what turned out to be the only program grant awarded outside North America to study ovarian cancer from the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program of the US Department of Defense. It's not an organization you typically think of as funding ovarian cancer research, but for odd historical reasons, DOD has a very large cancer research program that has nothing to do with shooting people. And embedded in that is a program on ovarian cancer. And the budget last year for that was $28 million a year, so that's actually a very substantial amount of money. And in 2000, we won a program grant that allowed us to start the Australian Ovarian Cancer Study. And basically what we realised was that ovarian cancer is a very complicated disease with many different types, as I'll explain. And the only way that we could really set up a powerful research program to address it was to recruit a very large number of women who were presenting for surgery for ovarian cancer, and then to recruit them and consent them to be involved in the study, and where possible to collect their tumour samples and a blood sample and information about them and their dietary history and number of kids they'd had and oral contraceptive use, everything that we could think of, and then after their surgery follow them through the course of their disease and make use of that resource to ask a whole variety of research questions. And so AOCS has become a research platform, if you like, to enable research. And it's enabled research, I think at last count it was about 85 different projects in 6 or 7 countries. Australia, of course, but also the US, UK, Japan, Norway. There's a few others up there, I think. And so AOCS as a resource is available to any scientist worldwide who has a good idea. And they can apply to AOCS, and then there's a sort of a scientific review to make sure that the science justifies the use of this very precious resource. And then, if that's the case, then we make that material available to the researcher on a purely cost recovery basis. We don't make any profit out of that. And so, without really setting out to do it, AOCS has become the largest study of its kind in the world. And most of the women were recruited from 2002 to 2006, but we've continued to recruit women on a smaller scale and particularly focus on different parts of their disease. The particular focus nowadays is on when the cancer comes back and trying to collect samples in that setting and understand the basis of how some women might be very responsive to initial chemotherapy, but the cancer comes back and becomes resistant. So that's probably the overwhelming focus of activity for our lab, to try and understand what makes a cancer that was once sensitive resistant to treatment. And it's been very successful. So I think at last count there are 150 publications a day, basically a publication a week from AOCS. I should point out, I'd love all of those publications to be out of my lab. They're certainly not. Our lab published about 30 last year of different things. But AOCS, as I said, it supports all sorts of research. So this is just a screen dump. You might not, I don't know if we can have the lights down a little bit. But you might be able to read some of this. I kind of color-coded it. The colors haven't come out so clearly. Essentially, what I've done is coded for yellow was environmental risk factors, which is known as epidemiological studies. Things like whether women used talc or what their diet was, or did they smoke, or how much did they drink, that sort of thing. The bluish colored ones are genetic risk factors, studies associated with genetic risk factors, and this is a different color, you might perhaps think that that's red on my screen. And that's looking at the biology of the tumors, and many of those papers are actually from our lab. So not only is it a resource for research, it actually covers a very wide spectrum, from everything to do with environmental risk factors to genetic risk factors, to try and understand the biology of the tumors. And these are just the publications for 2013 and a couple from 2014 already. As I said, it's about a paper a week at the moment. So it's enormously productive. AOCS is easily the most productive program of ovarian cancer research in Australia, and one of the most productive in the world now. And it involves lots of people. This is sort of a cast of about a cast of thousands, but certainly well over 100 clinicians, scientists, and researchers from all around Australia, and some from overseas. And some of those names might be familiar to some of the people here. AOCS is not related to OCRF. I don't mean that in a bad way, but sometimes people who participate in AOCS say, "Oh, I would really like to, donate some money to AOCS." We've donated some money to AOCS, and say, "Well, we actually haven't received anything." And it turns out they've donated it somewhere else. So if you want to support AOCS or OCA, who is a partner with us, we're not part of OCRF. That's the one with all the billboards and so on. So as I said, we've been very interested in these sort of three broad areas: environmental exposure, genetic risk, and what makes the tumours tick. This is a picture of the genome, or part of the genome of the tumour. Describe that a bit more. What also is unique about AOCS is looking at the interaction of these things. These arrows are quite meaningful. So, for example, whenever someone develops a disease, whether it's ovarian cancer or bowel cancer or cardiovascular disease, it's never one thing or another. It's a combination of genes and environment. And what a lot of the studies have been about have been trying to find a gene for this, or an environmental risk factor for that. And AOCS is big enough and participates now in other consortia around the world to ask how those genes and environment might interact in order to finally generate a cancer or another disease. And the focus for our lab has been very much on what makes the tumours tick and what can we learn about the different types of ovarian cancer. I'll say something about that in a moment. As I mentioned, why some women fail initial treatment, and which is called primary resistance, and why some develop resistance. Now, my kids are often kind of laughing at my analogies, but I think analogies are sometimes good when you're dealing with complicated areas. And so here's the first analogy, and I provide it because when I start talking about genes, it can be really kind of hard to follow if you don't know what a gene is. And the analogy I would give you of what's gone on in the biological sciences is quite similar in a way to what's gone on in astronomy. So this is actually my telescope and my dog, and I made this, so So I'm very proud of it, and usually try to get it into a 12-month plan. And so on a good night, if you look out and look at Mars, you can sort of make out that there's this ball, and you can make out the sort of the polar ice caps on a very good night when Mars is close enough. But for centuries, that's about all that we could see, and people, you know, theorized about canals and civilizations and all that sort of thing. But really, this enormous planet, you know, all that information there, all you can see is something ball and very little detail. But then, about 20 years ago, the Mars Global Surveyor was developed, and it orbited around Mars at, I think, about 5,000 kilometers. And now, you could actually see river valleys and volcanoes, or extinct volcanoes, and you could see structural features that would be much more, you know, familiar to us here on Earth. And then the Spirit rover, and I think what's Curiosity now, was put down on the surface, and you can see detail down to grains. Okay, you can see incredible detail. So basically resolution, or, you know, the ability to see things here is being driven very much by technology. Sort of old technology, newer technology, and the newest technology. And exactly the same thing has happened in biology just in the last 15, 20 years. So for many years, scientists could look down a microscope, which is sort of the equivalent of a telescope, and look down in cells and see these chromosomes inside a cell. And if they looked in cancer cells, they could tell that things had gone awry. Bits of the chromosomes were broken and joined together in certain ways. And the very first example of that was really tied to cancer is called the Philadelphia chromosome. That always occurs in a type of leukemia. So scientists knew that the things that were going on in the chromosomes was very important in terms of the cancer, but they didn't really know precisely what was going on, because a chromosome is actually a length of DNA. I'll explain this a bit more in a moment. And it had been broken and joined, but there was no way of telling what that meant to the cell at that level of resolution. And then about 10 years ago, this technology was developed. It's a little device that's about the size of a half a credit card, I suppose. And embedded in it is a chip. And on that chip are millions of pieces of DNA. And without going into the technology, what that allowed us to do was to measure the activity of the 20,000 genes in each of our cells in cancer and compare that to normal tissue and make inferences about how the code in the cell had been changed. I'll explain this a bit more detail in a moment. And then most recently, this amazing box, or boxes like it, have been developed, which now are the equivalent of the Spirit rover, which you can see the sort of ghostly shadow up here. And that allows us to get right down to the individual bases in the code in the genome of the cell and tell what's going wrong with the cell. And that's a really remarkable thing. That's not been possible until the last sort of 5 years. 5 years ago, would have cost over $1 million to sequence the genome of any of the people in this audience. Now we can do that for a little over $1,000. So it's dropped 1,000-fold in 5 years. And so that means that we can do things now that before were just completely impossible. We've got our Spirit rover that we can put down on the surface of the cell and read what's going wrong in the cell. People often ask me whether, you know, we signed up for the gym the other day, and the guy was sort of, you know, the personal trainer was asking me questions and said, oh, you know, what do you do? And I said, oh, I work in cancer research. And he said, oh, yeah, there's no money in a cure, though, is there? You know, and often people think that there's a conspiracy, that people really don't want a cure, and that, you know, the pharma industry doesn't want a cure because it's just better to give people drugs and sort of string them along. And I said to him, you know, it's kind of like saying to someone in the Second World War, you know, there's a conspiracy to keep Hitler alive so we can keep fighting, you know. And the sooner you can get it over with, the better, basically. And so researchers very actively form consortia to try and address major questions. And this is one that we're proud to be part of. It's called the International Cancer Genome Consortium. And the circle is around ovarian cancer, and that says Australia underneath. And we're the only active study in ICGC in the world. This is our study here at Peter Mac and with our collaborators nationally, to try and map all the important mutations that occur in all human cancers. And for the first time, this will create a complete blueprint of what goes wrong in cancer cells, not just in ovarian cancer, but in bowel cancer and lung cancer and so on. And as you'll see towards the end of the talk, that blueprint is absolutely crucial to a complete change in the way that cancer medicine is provided through a much more personalised approach. So that's a bit about ASCS. The first thing I want to really talk about, I guess, is ovarian cancer and how it isn't like what we thought it was. And here's another analogy. So I hope I'm not going to offend any Scottish people with Scottish ancestry in the audience by comparing Scotland to a cancer, but stay with me for a moment. So here's Scotland here, and it's a country, and all the people in it are Scots, right? Well, actually, you know, if you said that to a Forbes or a Fraser, they would be deeply offended, because there are obviously different types of Scottish people, different clans, and you can tell them by the patterns of their tartans on their kilts. And the same is true, has been true about cancer. This is essentially the way for decades people have approached the classification of cancer. It's partly based on anatomy, it's either breast cancer, or ovarian cancer, or pancreatic cancer, or kidney cancer. And then pathologists look down the microscope, and much like looking at the kilts of Scotsmen, you look at the patterns of the cells and you group them. And instead of calling them Forbes and Frasers, you give them names like mucinous, endometrioid, clear cell, and high grade serous. And these are histological terms that tell the clinicians and the pathologists something about the cancer, how the patient is likely to do. In principle, it should actually tell you how to treat them, but ovarian cancer up till very recently, and still largely the case, has been treated as a single disease. But the idea is to take a sample of the cancer, divide it into its group, make some conclusions, and move forward with the patient's treatment. And up till very recently, it's been believed that these four main types of ovarian cancer, this one being the most common type of epithelial ovarian cancer, all came from the surface of the ovary. So these little dots of cells in the ovary, which is sort of out here, it's already blown up, obviously. And this lining on the top of the ovary was thought to give rise to all these different types of ovarian cancer, and that's why they're all called ovarian. Well, this is a different way of, colours really do look different on my screen, but anyway, this is a different way of classifying cancers that turns out to be much more informative, and this is using one of those devices. This was like the Mars Global Surveyor, and each of these dots, you won't be able to make them out, it's the activity of a gene in a particular patient. So there's about 250 tumours across here from 250 different women, and we've used these devices on each of their cancers, and we've measured the activity of 20,000 genes in those cancers, and the computer has divided them up into four groups based on their activity, and that turns out to be a much, much more informative way of classifying the cancers. And to cut a long story short, and I won't go into detail in some of the papers here, that those sort of studies allowed us to realise that instead of these all being from the ovaries, these cancers actually are very different to each other. In fact, this cancer here is no more like this cancer here than a breast cancer is like a renal cancer. And in fact, this cancer here is more like a type of breast cancer, basal breast cancer, than it is any of these. And this one here is more like a type of kidney cancer than it is like any of these. So this name, ovarian cancer, is really for a group of cancers that share an anatomical location, the pelvic space, but almost nothing else. And in fact, most of them don't come from the ovary. So these mucinous cancers actually tend to be metastases from the colon or from the appendix or sometimes from the stomach. These endometrioid and clear cell cancers arise from cells that are swept up and out through the fallopian tubes during menstruation and give rise to endometriosis, and in a small proportion of women go on to form either clear cell or endometrioid cancers. And these ones here, which account for about 2/3 of the cases, don't actually come from the ovary, they come from the fallopian tubes, which are near the ovary, sort of like a catcher's mitt for the egg when ovulation occurs. So I'll give you a couple of slides as to why that's so important. And this is a young woman who was 32 at the time. This is her history over a period of 5 years. This is her CA125 count. Many of you will know what that means. So that's a biomarker of how the tumour is growing in her and how it's responding to treatment. And she had an ovarian clear cell cancer. And our work in the lab had shown that there was a very striking molecular relationship between ovarian clear cell cancer and renal clear cell cancer. And in renal clear cell cancer, there's a drug called sunitinib, SU-10, which is standard of care for renal cancer. And through a sort of a lucky convergence of events, this patient went on to a trial of sunitinib for her cancer. But this is her CA125 before she went on the trial. Over here is the sunitinib. So her CA125 plummeted after she had surgery and chemotherapy. But probably most of this fall was due to the surgery getting rid of the cancer rather than responding to the chemotherapy, because almost as soon as the chemotherapy had finished, the CA125 started to rise. And then it went straight through this drug here, which is called letrozole, completely unaffected by that drug. She then went on to Calix, liposomal doxorubicin, and she had a small fall in the CA125, but then it rebounded very quickly after the chemotherapy was finished. And she was very ill at the time, and she then went on to sunitinib. And you can see no surgery here, just the drug. The CA125 falls like a stone, comes back in the 2 weeks that she goes off treatment as part of the protocol, let's say, falls again back when she came off treatment, and then she went on to continuous sunitinib and stayed on it for a period of 2 years and had a really remarkable response to the sunitinib that was completely different to the standard chemotherapy. So really it's just screaming at you that this is a different disease that requires a different therapy, and we can gain knowledge by comparing it to other cancers where they might be a bit in front, and that's what happened in the case of this patient. So this reclassification turns out to be really very important, and it's something that we've been very active in, and I think now we have a much better idea of what goes where in ovarian cancer than we did 5 years ago. So in a sense this phase is perhaps even drawing to a close, or it just needs some more refinement. But it really is bringing about a change in the way that ovarian cancer is managed, and this sort of one-size-fits-all approach now just won't do. And there are clinical trials underway for the different histotypes of ovarian cancer to try and have a much more targeted approach to them. As I'll go on to show you, we now know that the genetic risk factors like the BRCA genes are not for ovarian cancer in general. They are associated with very specific histotypes, those patterns of ovarian cancer, and that's important in terms of managing it and recognising opportunities for managing genetic risk. there's no way that biologists can figure out the biology of this if we treat it as a sort of a mixture. You will never find associations between biology and clinical behaviour if you're dealing with a heterogeneous group of samples. So we have to segregate things into their groups in order to understand what makes them tick. And we also, knowing where they come from influences our strategies for prevention. So for example, recognising that high-grade serous cancers, which are the cancers that women with BRCA mutations are at risk of developing, come from the fallopian tube, means that don't just remove the ovary. If you're going to do that, remove the fallopian tubes as well, because that's where the cancer is going to come from. So there are things that can be done that will cut women's risk a lot when they've had their children and they're perimenopausal and they've been through menopause, as long as we know which bits to remove. So this stuff might seem a little less esoteric, but it has very immediate and very practical consequences for people, like not in 5 years' time, but now. So I want to talk a bit now about genetic risk and how the picture is clearer there. And the thing that looks maybe a bit like a hot dog is actually a bacteria, the type that causes traveller's diarrhoea. And to sort of not put too fine a point on it, someone's kind of given it a squish, more or less. And spilling out from it is this, can you make out the strands? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the DNA. So DNA is actually, it's not some sort of artificial kind of imaginary thing that happens inside a cell. It is real stuff. It's a living, in this case in a bacteria, it's a long circular molecule, and it encodes everything that that bacteria needs to do to be a bacteria. We're obviously a bit bigger and more sophisticated than bacteria, or most people are. And so we've got more DNA, more code, more things that need to be done and organised. And so there's more DNA in us, maybe 10,000 times as much. And so in us, the DNA is in a series of linear, long pieces, like a long piece of string, molecules. But you can see that this stuff, there's lots of this stuff even in this little bacteria. So if it wasn't packaged, it would just be a mess inside the cell. The cells are so small you can't even see them. They're tiny, tiny little things. And yet, packed into each cell is about 3 meters of DNA. Just an extraordinary thing that you can put that, 3 feet, sorry, 3 feet of DNA into one cell that you can't even see. Can you imagine trying to stuff 3 feet of something into something you can't even see? And so it's packaged up in chromosomes, and that's what the chromosomes are. So when you hear the name chromosome, it's just DNA in packets, basically. Now this is a demographic test of the audience, actually. There will be some people in the room that can recognise what this means, and others that don't. So don't be shy. Is there anyone that knows what this represents? There we go. Yes. People of my generation. Yeah, it's a knitting pattern. So if I was to look at this, my wife's a really good knitter, it's just complete gibberish to me, basically. But if you know what that thing is, what it's one of these, basically. This is from the 80s, actually. I don't know why women don't look adoring anymore. But anyway, that makes that, if you know what to do. And that, and that, makes that, and that. So DNA is simply a code, and it's a real thing. We don't have A's and T's and G's and C's in us. They're the abbreviation of the chemical names of each of the four bases that make up DNA. And the cell is very clever, and it reads the DNA in the same way that we read letters, make up sentences, make up paragraphs, make up pages in a novel. So that makes up letters. The letters go together, or they make up... It's read in threes, and each three encodes an amino acid, and an amino acid's like a bead on a string, and if you put enough of them together you end up with a protein, and a protein's the functional unit. So keratin in our hair is made by the keratin gene that sends a code down to the cell, that your skin, that makes keratin, and the code dictates the biophysical properties of the protein. So if you want something that is hair-like, then you make a certain sort of protein. And if you want something that's more like hemoglobin, to carry oxygen with iron, then you make a different sort of protein. So we have about 20,000 of these genes, and the cell is extremely clever in how it uses the information, and it can make these things. So it's everything to build a person and to run a person through life, basically. And if you're a molecular biologist, you might not be able to read a knitting pattern, but you can read this stuff. We use computers to help us, and we've learned not only to how to sequence individuals but actually interpret that sequence, and we're still finding hidden messages in the code. It's incredibly complex, but we now know a lot about our sequence. That's just as well, because there's a lot of it. So this is from the Sanger Institute in Hingston in Cambridge, and this poster, which you can't see, is covered in 7-point font, pretty small in Times New Roman, I think, or Korea. And this is a bit of it here. And that is part of the X chromosome. And women have 2 X chromosomes, and that's what makes them women. And men have an X and a Y, and then you have another 22 pairs of chromosomes. And so this poster is 1.5 meters wide and 8 meters high to two stories high. And if you took all of the code from our genome and wrote it out in 7-point font, it would cover the floor of the MCG from one cell. So when people say, you know, what are you guys doing? You know, why can't you get this sorted? It's actually a complex problem. It's a seriously complex problem. So we've had to develop the technology that allows us in the first place to read the very first sequence. It was only 2003 that the first human genome sequence was solved. We had to be able to read the sequence and actually understand the sequence. So, you know, imagine if you'd never been taught English and you try to pick up a novel and understand it. You might see that there are letters in there. You might have the book in your hand, but you can't interpret what it means. So we had to teach ourselves, you know, what this stuff means, and then understand how that code is corrupted in a cancer cell, and then understand how it's corrupted in an individual person's cancer. And that's why it's so hard. That's why it's been so slow. So now let's sort of keep the analogy going. So here's a lymphocyte blown up enormously, because you can see it, and this thing is its nucleus, and the nucleus is where all the DNA resides. Keep things nice and neat. And here's this laptop, which is remarkably like this laptop. And these both have operating systems. So the operating system here is made of DNA, and it has an instruction code, which you're all now full bottle with. And the operating system on this is its software. And if it's a Mac, it's a Mac OS. And if it's a PC, like this one down here, it's Windows, right? And so, you know, a laptop can be born with either a great operating system or a dodgy operating system. And the same is true about us, unfortunately. So you can be born with a great operating system and smoke a pack of cigarettes every day of your life and live to 86, or you can do everything right and still go on and develop cancer. And this is an example of a family with inherited breast and ovarian cancer, and I think it's kind of insulting in these pedigree trees that the women are round and the men are square, but anyway, that's how they're drawn, women being round. And this is 1, 2, 3, 4 generations, and black means that the person has been affected, and line through them means that they've died of their disease. This woman dying of uterine cancer at 68, breast cancer, breast cancer, breast cancer, breast cancer, ovarian cancer here. Here's another case. This person has an inherited bowel cancer, and each of these little pimples is the start of a cancer in their bowel. And this is a different mutation. This is in a gene called APC, quite different to the BRCA genes, which is the BRCA2 mutation in this family. Yeah. So what are these genes doing? BRCA1 and BRCA2, many of you will have heard of them. And here's another analogy that I like. And they form part of the machine. So the DNA is the gene, and it tells the cell how to make a protein, so BRCA1 and BRCA2. And those proteins go together in a machine to repair DNA. And so in a sense, they go together like cogs and springs and hands and so on go together in a clock to be a clock. And so our machines are in a way are no different. They're just that they're made of protein rather than bits of metal and so on. And it turns out that BRCA1 and BRCA2 are really like big clocks, are big cogs in this machine. They're very, very important to that machine. And if they're damaged, it really affects the cell's ability to repair the DNA when it's damaged. And so those mutations tend to be highly penetrant, as a genetic term. Penetrant means that if you carry the mutation, your risk of developing the cancer is quite high. So that's essentially what this is saying, and that the risk of developing ovarian cancers varies from 5 to 18%. Actually, that's not right. It's higher than that. It's around 40%. And up to now, family history has been the key determinant as to whether someone's been offered genetic testing. So that's what the BRCA genes do. This is a study that we published 2 years ago from Catherine Norsop, which I'm proud to say actually changed the genetic testing guidelines in Australia and in countries around the world. And what we wanted to know was, we knew that the risk of developing ovarian cancer or breast cancer is quite high if you carry these mutations. What was poorly understood was, if a woman walks through the door with ovarian cancer, what's the risk that she's actually carrying a mutation? So it's sort of the flip side, if you like. And that figure was thought to be around 5 to 10%. That 5 to 10% of people, leaving aside their family history, that, that had ovarian cancer would carry one of the BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations. We wanted also to know whether the mutation influenced treatment and whether the genetic testing guidelines should be changed. And we dipped into the AOCS resource and we tested 1,000 women with ovarian cancer, obviously with their consent, to find out what was the really true frequency of these mutations in the population. And we're really surprised, actually. It wasn't 5 to 10%. It was in, it was basically 18%, and it was almost all in these high-grade serous cancers. So it's not 5 to 10% of ovarian cancers. It's around 18% of high-grade serous cancers. Now, we found some cancers, some mutations in clear cell and endometrioid cancers, but when we went back and rechecked the pathology, they turned out to be actually high-grade serous cancers that had been misclassified during the diagnosis as being clear cell and endometrioid cancers. So this is an example of where it's really a function of those mutations tracked with this disease. And did it influence treatment? Yes, it did. It had a big, carrying these mutations had a big impact on treatment and how the women did. And you can read the paper, but basically the conclusion of the paper was that BRCA cases do best with platinum than other drugs, and they should persist with platinum until there's very objective evidence that they're developing resistance to that drug. And should the genetic testing guidelines be changed? Yes, in exclamation mark, because half of the patients that we picked up that were carriers did not have sufficient family histories to trigger being offered genetic testing, so they would have been missed. And therefore the opportunity to reduce the risk in their daughters and sisters and so on would have been missed. So now in Australia, the genetic testing guidelines say that any woman with invasive ovarian cancer should be offered genetic testing, and that has changed in other countries too, in large part because of this study. And we think that's a very useful thing. And is it useful? No, yes, because you can cut the risk of developing a cancer in a non-affected individual by 80 to 90%, very substantially. In terms of other genes, as I said, they're part of this machine, and we now have found some of the other smaller cogs, if you like. These are genes that have funny names, LB2, RAD51, CND18, BARD1, BRIP, and so on. And so now, because the sequencing is so fantastic, it's actually just as easy to sequence for all of these as it is to sequence for just BRCA1 and BRCA2. And that has been given the name BROCA, which actually goes back to Paul Broca, who was one of the first people to discover inherited ovarian cancer over 100 years ago. And so in sort of the, it's kind of a play on the term of BRCA sequencing, but it's called Broca sequencing. I put it up there just because you might come across it. The really important thing to know is that at the moment we have very clear ideas about what to do and what the implications are if we find these mutations. If we find mutations in these genes, it's harder to know whether the mutation is actually deleterious, how much risk might be associated with that, and what should be done about finding the mutation. And so although it's technically possible to search for these mutations, a lot of the familial cancer clinics at the moment are not testing for them because we don't know how to act on the information and we're trying to figure that out at the moment. And then there are other genes that have really small effects. They might increase the risk by 50%, which sounds like a lot, but it's actually in terms of lifetime risk, it's quite small. And we think of these as being more like contributing to a good hand of cards. So if you imagine every time a baby's created, you know, a pack of cards from dad and a pack of cards from mum, and the cards are shuffled and a new deck of 20,000 is dealt, and you just might be unlucky enough to get some twos and threes and so on, where you accumulate some of these not great copies of genes, and the cumulative effect of those things might mean that now if you intersect with the wrong environment, you're going to develop ovarian cancer. And so don't take from this that everyone that develops ovarian cancer carries devastating genes. They don't. And many of them, we think, are where it's a mixture of things. And then when the next generations form, the cards are shuffled again. And so you may break apart this bad combination and put together with some better combinations. And so cancers may come and go from families, in a sense, as a result of that. So the genetic picture is mixed. There are these high-risk, high-penetrance genes in a significant proportion, but mainly in high-grade serous cancer patients. There are these smaller cogs that are part of the same machine, which also have a moderate influence. And then there are these even smaller effects of many genes that cumulatively might add up to a cancer in a person. This is complicated stuff in terms of how to counsel people and how to test. So the technology, in a sense, is ahead of knowing how to use that information. Early detection. Why isn't there an early detection test? 95% of cancers are cured at stage 1 and 30% at stage 3. What are you doing, amazing people? It's a really tough one. And it has to do with the biology of ovarian cancer, nothing to do with people's effort. So this is a paper that was published in 2011, the PLCO study. So this is a very large US study. PLCO stands for prostate, lung, ovary and colorectal cancer. And it was a study of screening many women with CA125 to see if they could reduce the mortality in the screened population. And the outcome of that was actually no. In fact, it was slightly higher mortality in the screened population, some of which was associated with interventions triggered by a screen result. So when you're thinking about early detection tests, there's a lot of stuff, and there isn't time to go into it now, where you need to be very, as a consumer, very aware. The really important thing is, does the screen population live for longer? Not how many cancers you detect, or whether you detect them earlier, bottom line, does it live for longer? And in the PLCO study, the answer to that is no. There's a more sophisticated trial that's been running for about 20 years, 15 years in the UK, called the UK CTOX trial. It involves 200,000 women. In addition to CA125, they use ultrasound as well as part of the screening test, and they use a rise in CA125 rather than sort of a single measurement. It's called the ROC analysis. And that study will report next year as to whether there's a benefit in the screened population, and the current indications suggest that probably it won't be a benefit in the screened population. And at the moment, the guidelines indicate that there is no benefit in screening at-risk women using ultrasound and CA125. So why is that? There are a few reasons. The first one is that ovarian cancer is very heterogeneous, so it's very difficult to have a single test that's going to pick up all of them. The second thing is that it's an uncommon disease. It might not feel like it to some of you, but it is actually an uncommon disease. So if you had 10,000 women at the MCG over 50, three of them would have ovarian cancer and they wouldn't know it. So it's about 1 in 3,000 people walking around out there have ovarian cancer and they don't know it. So 3 out of 10,000 women. So if you come along with a test that's 99% specific, in other words, it's right 99 times out of 100, which sounds great, doesn't it? 99 times out of 100, they can't buy that. And it picks up every ovarian cancer case. And you screen those 10,000 women, you'll have 100 positives out of the test. Three of them will be real, 3%. So that means you're going to put 100 women through a lot of intervention and worry and so on, and potentially health effects associated with following up on that, find the three, and you still don't know whether you're going to benefit. So, and the reason that's so difficult is that unlike cervical cancer, where screening is fantastically effective, in ovarian cancer the biology works against it. So it forms in the fallopian tube, or maybe sometimes in the surface of the ovaries, cells swept in from elsewhere. And there is no barrier for that to just set sail and spread through the rest of the abdomen. It doesn't have to burst through any cell layers or anything like that. It can just float through the abdomen. So people go from being stage 1 to stage 3 almost instantly, in a way. And it's deep. It's not very accessible, no one likes it without a pap screen, obviously, but, no one likes that, but it's accessible. And there is a long window of time between something that someone doing a PAP screen can see and the development of frank cancer. So if you're screened every year or two, there'll be enough time for something starting to occur and preventing it. Whereas for the ovarian cancer, we think it sort of occurs recently. Time from it occurring to spreading is short, so the chance of hitting that window is very short. So it's not for a lack of trying. It's not because, you know, ovarian cancer is a neglected field compared to breast cancer. The biology works against us, basically. And that's the reason why an early detection test is so difficult. And that's why, also, you don't just create an early detection test and put it out there. You do what they've done in the UK, and it's cost £35 million at last count, over CTOX, the actual trial. This trial they're going to report on, I think, will have been running for over 10 years to see if there's a benefit in the screen population. So even if a test is out there tomorrow, there are years of actually proving whether that actually benefits the screen population, whether the screen population lives longer. So what does that leave us with? You either use genetics or epidemiology to prevent disease. So you either know about risk factors and stop it occurring, or you come up with better treatments for the women who unfortunately are going to develop it next year or tomorrow and so on. And that's not really palatable to any of us. We'd like to prevent it or detect it much more early, but that's what we're kind of left with. So the epidemiological risk factors are not useful. Fewer children. People don't make decisions based on ovarian cancer risk about that. But the genetic risk factors are useful. So we can use that information and we can cut risk by being aware of the genetic risk when it's relevant. And we can also do something about this, which is very important. So I really want to finish with this now, I'm conscious of the time, and talk about some of the promise of the new therapies. And you know, as I said at the beginning, I've got plenty of personal involvement in this. And so what I'm going to present to you is hopefully a balanced view of where things are at and what we're trying to do, not kind of the cure for cancer tomorrow. So the field is in transition from anatomically based therapies, bowel cancer, kidney cancer, ovarian cancer, to molecularly guided therapy that is individualized. So it's therapy where you look at the changes in that code in an individual and you make treatment decisions based on changes that have occurred in that cancer. So this is a circuit diagram of a cell. You can't see it. It's wildly complicated. And basically, it's understanding that code in the cell, find the key events that are driving a cancer. It might only be six or a dozen really key events in a person's cancer out of all that code. Find those targets, which can be in sort of a needle in a haystack, make a drug that will inhibit the protein that's made as a consequence of that, and give that drug to the person who has the problem. No point in giving the drug to someone who has a different problem with the code in their tumor. And so I want to talk about these PARP inhibitors because these are actually very important. They're a class of drugs that were developed particularly to target cancers that arise in women with BRCA mutations, but they are relevant to a significant fraction of women who have high-grade serous cancers as well, because there are other ways that that machine, you know, the clock that I showed you, that little clock, can be broken beyond just having a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, and these drugs are probably relevant. And what they do is that it's a sort of a jiu-jitsu move. You know, jiu-jitsu is the idea is you use the enemy's sort of weight against themselves. You know, you use their weaknesses, you exploit them. And in a BRCA mutation, they're defective in DNA repair, and that's why the cancer gets going. But that creates a vulnerability in the cell, because when you damage the DNA, it can't repair it properly, and the normal cells stop what they're doing, and they fix it, mostly. And go on, but the cancer cells just kind of keep going and can't repair it, and they die catastrophically. And that's why platinum works so well, because it attacks that process. And the PARP inhibitors belong in that sort of class. Now, these drugs have had a bit of a checkered history. They initially showed very prominent results, and then over the last couple of years, they sort of the whole development of them stalled for not very good reasons that we could talk about. And now new trials are kicking off with those. And so there are four trials that have opened in Melbourne that are using two different ARP inhibitors. One's called the Laparib, the other one's called Rucaparib here. And the study's called Solo 1 and Solo 2, Area 1 and Area 2. And there's also the Solace trial, which is the smallest trial which will enroll far fewer patients. These are phase 2 trials. And they are in different settings. So this is for women who have just finished their surgery and they're starting chemotherapy. And they'll go on to a laparib or a placebo. And 2 to 1 means that there'll be 2 women in this group and 1 in the placebo group. And then the Solo 2 trial, this is for women where the cancers come back and they receive chemotherapy again, but also in conjunction with the laparib. Now the key thing about it is that there has to be a sufficiently long period between their first chemotherapy and their next chemotherapy for them to be regarded as being likely to be sensitive to platinum. It's called platinum sensitive disease. And so that's an inclusion criteria for the study. And in the aerial trials, they're similar to the solar trials. And the Solace trial is similar again. And so if this is relevant, you should talk to your oncologist if it comes up. Many of you will know about bevacizumab. It's a drug called Avastin. It targets a completely different process. It targets the ability of the cancer cells to co-opt the blood supply to bring in new blood supply into the tumor and tries to cut that off. And also improve uptake of chemotherapy. There have been many trials, phase 3 trials, thousands of women. The survival effects are relatively small with this drug. There are clearly some women who gain a very considerable benefit from bevacizumab. And where the field's at the moment is trying to understand who those women are, because a really key part of these very expensive drugs is to try and target them to the women who are going to benefit from the most. At the moment, I have nothing to do with shares in Roche or anything like that, but we're trying to get this under the PBAC so that it becomes dollars instead of thousands of dollars. But before that happens, Roche has an access program for women in this situation where they pay $10,000, a lot of money, for the first 2 treatments, and if they get a response, Roche then provides the drug on an ongoing basis after that. As I said, this has been recommended to the pharmaceutical benefit scheme for funding, but that hasn't happened yet. We're hopeful that that will happen soon. I just want to leave you with this one, and this stuff, immunotherapy in cancer has a long history of decades, and it's been an absolute roller coaster from being very, very exciting to being in the depths, and there's sort of been about 10 years between the peaks. It's absolutely at a peak at the moment, and it's extremely important and very, very, very interesting. There are now a class of drugs called the immune checkpoint inhibitors, and basically they're involved in this. So here's a cancer cell. And this is a killer T cell. It's a type of white blood cell. And think of it like an assassin with a knife that goes around stabbing other cells. And usually what it does is it stabs virally infected cells. But it can also kill cancer cells. And I won't go into the details of how it recognizes cancer cells from the normal cells, but it can. And unfortunately, what the tumor cells do is that they make a little hormone. This one's called B7. This one's called PD-L1. And they go across to the cancer cell, to the T cell, and these T cells have receptors on the surface that bind the hormone, and they switch off the immune cell, and they turn off the immune response. And they do that for reasons that have to do with normal immune biology, nothing to do with people not behaving properly or, not eating the right thing. But these devilish sort of cancer cells are able to co-opt the normal biology and turn off this. And what these drugs do is they block this activity. So there are anti-PD-L1 antibodies, anti-PD-1 antibodies, anti-CTLA-4 antibodies. This one here is called Yervoy, ipilimumab, very odd names. These ones have not yet given names, completely experimental. In a minority, but a significant minority of renal, lung and melanoma patients, there have been extraordinary responses to these drugs, like really amazing responses to them. People going from, there was one woman involved in our autopsy study, enrolled to go in the autopsy study, wasn't expected to live a week. She's just passed a year, she's back at work, melanoma. And this is really amazing, kind of hair-raising stuff. And so there is huge excitement about getting these drugs into ovarian cancer trials, and we're working very hard to get them into Australia and into ovarian cancer trials. And we're hopeful that they, I won't go into the science, but they will may particularly work in BRCA carriers because they seem to have quite a strong immune response that can be turned back on. So watch this space. This, I think, is a very exciting development, and I'm not one to sort of overly hype things. I think that that's something to be well aware of. So I think my time is up. Where to next? We've got a much better idea. The clouds have parted, basically, on this disease. We've got a much better idea of the different types, the need for subtype-specific therapies. It actually does turn out to be like a babushka doll. You know, you think it's one doll, and you open it, and it's two. More. At some stage, we will get to the bottom of the babushka doll. We've got a fair way in. We're still going. And what we need then is a therapy for each of the dolls, each of the types. Genetics is a lot clearer. We've changed genetic testing guidelines. I think that will actually save some lives. We're developing that complete blueprint. I think that will be finished probably in about 2 to 3 years. One of the really key areas, I think, of research is understanding recurrence. I think too many people are well aware of the fact that these things can be responsive and then evolve to becoming resistant. And, you know, I'm just writing in the middle. If I look tired, I've been up writing grants, so grant season for us. And we're just in the middle of writing a grant that says we've contributed data on 1,000 cases to our studies, about 300 worldwide, about 1,000 cases of high-grade serous cancers, where we've done all this genetic blueprinting. There are probably less than 50, maybe not even that, from women where the samples are collected during recurrence. And we know that cancers have evolved a long way on the chemotherapy, and we desperately need to get hold of samples when the cancers become resistant. So that's one of the things we're really actively working on. So I'll leave it at that point and be very happy to answer any questions if you've got any. Yeah, that's actually from our lab.
And some trials they're doing with that.
Yeah, so cyclin E1, so this is all stuff that's come from our lab. And so when a cell divides, it's a very intricate process. And they have to divide at the right time and stop at the right time. And cyclin E1 is a critical part of that. And what happens in some ovarian cancers is that the number of copies of the cyclin E1 gene is increased in the cell enormously. It's like it's been copied and copied and copied, and now instead of making a bit of cyclin E1 at the right time, it makes way too much of it, and it drives the cells into cell cycle. And if you can't actually inhibit cyclin E1 itself, but it's part of the machine, like the BRCA genes are part of the machine, and it particularly binds to an enzyme called a CDK2. And there are drugs to that, and it's that trial that we have funding for. We've got preclinical data for it. It's a terrific target. We have to get the drug company across the line to provide us with drugs, and that's very frustrating at the moment. And the reason that the company won't provide the drug at the moment is all their attention is focused on, you guessed it, these immune checkpoint inhibitors. So they see that as a more commercially viable area to be focusing. So we're hopeful, we've got the funding for the trial, we're hopeful that we'll be able to get the trial. We've got everything that we need for it. We've got a test that's been developed with a company in the United States to find the patients, and we've got all the infrastructure that we need to run the trial. We just need to get going, but it's in particular patients.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, I've just got a question about PAP.
Yes.
Has there been any research yet on if you've been on a PAP inhibitor trial,
yes,
and then the cancer reoccurs,
yes,
and later on you go back into remission, has there ever been a case that someone's gone back onto a PAP inhibitor trial?
I'm not sure. So now you're testing me because I'm a molecular biologist rather than a clinician.
That
is a very relevant question to ask now, because the SOLO and Aerial trials are kicking off, and it will be in the eligibility criteria as to whether you can go back on to a PARP inhibitor. My guess is that it's 50-50. My guess would be that it's 50-50.
Okay.
Whether you can go on, but that will be clearly laid out in the eligibility criteria for Aerial and the SOLO trials.
Yes.
If you're assembled back here in 5 years' time with yourself as guest speaker, what do you suspect your presentation might be based on?
If I had to put my money on anything, I'd put it on the immune checkpoint inhibitors, actually. I think what will happen to cancer is that the chemotherapy or the targeted therapy, the small molecules, will be basically like going in and chainsawing the forest, and that the immunotherapies will be going in with, you know, people with knapsack and just getting rid of every sucker that comes up. Basically, I think that's the way it'll go. The trick will be waking up an immune response in all of the patients. So there was a really amazing study published a couple of months ago where they looked at the evolution of the immune response in some patients, and there was this one particular patient where they collected a sample from her at surgery, and then a year later, and then another year later, and at the first recurrence, which was basically the first year, her cancer had now started to make some subtly altered proteins because they picked up a mutation that the immune system was recognizing. And they went back to her cancer that was there at surgery, and that mutation was there but very rare in the population, and there was no immune response to it. So it sort of made sense that this mutation had become prevalent in the population of cells in her, cancer cells in her body, and now there was an immune response to it, which was great. But then they looked at the immune response out at 2 or 3 years, I think it was, and the mutation was still there. It was actually in almost all the cancer cells, but the immune response to it was gone. So we don't know what happened there. Maybe it's like, you know, people with peanut allergies. If you give them enough and carefully controlled ways, enough peanuts, they'll become tolerant to it. Maybe that if you don't turn on the immune response in the right way at the right time, the body forgets that these foreign antigens are actually things that it should be targeting. So I think that the people who are most likely to benefit first will be the ones that carry the high mutation loads and are making a lot of foreign proteins in their cells. And that's why the biggest response has been seen in melanoma, lung, not obviously that way in renal, but in melanoma and lung, those cancers carry lots of mutations because they've been exposed to cigarettes and UV, and they make lots of foreign proteins. And so there's an immune response there that's recognizing it, but it's not effective. Turn it back on, and you get these remarkable responses. So where we think the equivalent of that will probably be the BRCA carriers, because they seem to carry lots of mutation and do have a florid immune response in their cancers, but it doesn't seem to be very effective. So I would say it will be targeted therapies, replacing chemotherapy, very personalized, clearing the forest, immunotherapies, wiping out the suckers.
Mm-hmm. Great question. Any further questions? Sorry. Just to talk about immune response reminds me of my oncologist who's constantly urging me to take vitamin D.
Right.
Is that something that you...
I don't know. Vitamin D, there's an interesting association between vitamin D and cancer, and latitude of cancer, actually. So less vitamin D exposure increases your risks of certain cancers. I don't know whether it's likely to have a therapeutic benefit when someone develops cancer. I don't know if there have been any intervention trials like that. I'm right? It's a water-soluble vitamin, so it's not like vitamin E. It doesn't accumulate in fat, so it shouldn't be dangerous. Although I do think you can take too much of it, but it should be okay, I think, if you're going to be guided by your clinician.
Thank you very much indeed, David.
You're welcome.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan's podcasts or browse existing ones at our website, www.brecan.org.au.